QSO Today, Episode 42, Carol Milazzo, KP4MD. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Huth, 4Z1UG, your host. My QSO Today is with Carol Milazzo, KP4MD. It is not very often that I get to speak with a woman in ham radio, but when I do, they are always major contributors to the hobby. Carol is no exception, and I hope that in the limited time that we have together, that we can give you a taste of what Carol has done for almost 50 years in the hobby. When doing the research for this episode and a review of Carol's body of work, I was blown away by the sheer volume of documentation prepared by Carol and her amazing attention to detail, including pictures, graphs, and footnotes. If you do not regularly visit the show notes pages on the QSO Today website, you should make a special trip after listening to this podcast just for the links to Carol's many projects. I could spend a day just reading the white papers that Carol has posted online on just about every ham radio subject that interests her. KP4MD, this is Eric, 4Z1UG. Are you there, Carol?
Yes, Eric. This is KP4MD. Loud and clear.
Well, I hope I didn't overwhelm you with your introduction, but I've never been on a website where there's just so much and it's so feature-rich. So before we start on that, can we start at the very beginning of your ham radio story? When and how did it start for you?
Certainly, Eric. Well, it started when I was a kid, back in New York City. Was always interested in science, and my parents were very much encouraging me to pursue that study. Started out with things just like with reading copies of popular science magazines, science and mechanics magazines that I'd see in the corner store, and eventually popular electronics, and there were some articles in there, different columns about things like shortwave listening and amateur radio, which just absolutely intrigued me. I have to say that back then in the 50s and the 60s, when transistors were starting to come out, transistor radios were a really popular thing. That had these little 4 and 5 transistor radios that kids would be listening to. And, of course, I had one. And I was amazed. I remember in grade school, I had my little transistor radio. I was tuning around, just amazed by all the stuff I was listening to. And while I was at school, I noticed that if you put this little AM radio up against a pole, a metal pole, like a basketball pole or something like that, it would actually work as an antenna and make the signals come in louder. By coupling to the little ferrite loop in it. And I just happened to be doing it one day when I heard this voice coming through, and it sounded like something like it wasn't a regular AM broadcast station. It was actually a person who was talking to someone else. I didn't hear the other side, but then I figured out what was going on. I was hearing one side of a conversation. I later figured out what was happening was I was hearing part of an amateur radio communication conversation that was coming through on an image from 80 meters AM. I figured that out. It was being picked up by this little AM radio. And I said, wow, this is something. I really, really piqued my interest. And, of course, I had relatives, like had aunts and uncles that had some of these old console radios that had shortwave bands on them, that on the dials you would see exotic names of places like Moscow and Peking and Berlin and stuff on the shortwave bands. So I knew stuff like that was there, and I was just absolutely intrigued. And we're talking about maybe in fifth, sixth, and seventh grade. I knew I would definitely wanted to go and pursue this. Something that would get me a little closer to that. So the first thing that I asked my dad to get was I wanted these transistor radios that had shortwave on them. And so back in 1966, I got a little transistor 3-band portable. which I used for picking up shortwave stations. And I found in popular electronics magazine, you could join this club just by registering with them, and they would give you this kind of a call sign for being a shortwave listener. And I started collecting QSL cards. I actually did start sending reports to some of these different stations and collecting QSL cards. Eventually, wanted to be able to talk to some of those people that I was hearing in two-way conversations on shortwave. I'm jumping ahead of myself a little bit here now.
Well, actually, you're not. I'm sitting here thinking about your story, and it like almost parallels mine. So, when did you get your first license?
I didn't actually get my first license until I was in high school. Because I was, I just didn't know any amateur operators. That back in those days, you had to know somebody that would give you a license test. Those were either a novice or a technicians were the first licenses that you could get. I didn't actually have that kind of connection until I was in high school, and I was. Connected with through a friend to Mark Grossman, who is a K2CON, who was a salesperson at Arrow Electronics in Manhattan. I remember going to him and saying that I wanted to go and take my exam because I had studied from some license manuals that you could get places like Lafayette Radio Electronics. The stores were around New York City at that time, and I learned Morse code by buying one of their LP records, you know, that you could play different speeds, you know, and I was able to get the 5 words per minute. It took me about a few weeks to get it that way before I had memorized the record. Mark Grossman, K2CRN, he was a little bit disappointed because I said I wanted to do the technician license. And he said, well, if I took the technician license, I'll probably be stuck there because so many people just get on VHF and never advance any further beyond that. And he was really trying to encourage me to get the novice license, which was not renewable at the time. But I just felt a little bit that I knew was really interested in the theory, and I knew that I could master the technician theory. So I went ahead and did that, and I have to say that I'm kind of happy that I did because it gave me an opportunity to do some operating on VHF and meet some of the local hams that perhaps I may not have so easily met if I had been stuck on HF on CW.
What was your first call sign?
My first call sign was WB2OZA, and I operated 2 meter AM. When I first got the license in May, I didn't have a rig until probably about 4 or 5 months later. I was in high school at the time, and my first rig was a night kit TR-108, which I bought through Allied Radio as a kit, and I put it together, and it's not the first kit I had built because I had built several kits prior to that. I had got the Heathkit catalog, and I built their little transistor tester. It was one of my first kits that I put together. It was a little simple diode and transistor tester. That's with that sort of thing I learned how to solder. And beyond that, I actually started building some other kits prior to getting the amateur radio license. I actually built a night kit oscilloscope. I was really, really intrigued. And, you know, I was in my early teens at that time, and I could say that perhaps my interests were a little bit different than a lot of other teens, but I just have to really thank my parents for encouraging me for pursuing my interest, and it went along with my interest in science. interest in physics. I was just a really voracious reader of anything I could get my hands on that had to do with science and specifically with electronics. So, I started on 2 meter AM. I had the TR-108, and I didn't have a proper antenna to begin with. What I had was a little long wire antenna I had been using for shortwave listening, and made my first contact with a station over in the west side of the Bronx, which is just about five miles away. Of course, I had a horrible signal operating off a long wire, and really rapidly I was talking with other hams in the area on 2 meter AM, which was what we used back then, and finally got a proper antenna up. We got up a 8-element Yagi on the house, and had lots of fun with that TR-108. It put out about 5 watts on AM, and I was crystal controlled at first, and eventually got a VFO, and then eventually got into 6 meters. Did some operating. I made some really good friends. I met other hams that were about my age as well, and we would talk regularly on the air. Just learning from nearby hams. And I have to say that's where I got my introduction to Amateur Radio Club eventually. And where could I go?
Well, I know where you could go. In reviewing your online body of work, you were adapting surplus equipment for 2 meters, very early in your ham radio career, and you were folding sheet metal to make chassis, and you were experimenting with antennas. You had some fantastic Elmers. Can you say who they were, or where you acquired these skills as a high school student?
Sure. I'd say one of my first Elmers was a fellow named John Jornet. His call is WA2, Mike Sierra Mike. I don't know if he's even still alive. I know he certainly is not listed in the online QRZ.com or anything like that anymore. But he was an older gentleman who would be active on 2 meters AM, and he would listen around and then join some of the younger groups of individuals like myself and other people of my age, and encourage us to get involved in public service. He was very active in MARS at that time, which is the Military Affiliated Radio System, and he encouraged us to participate in that and said, "Oh, we could operate on military frequencies, on VHF, and also get on HF, even though we had technician license at the time." And he invited us to go over to his home station, which was located in Jackson Heights, Queens, not very far away. And one good thing is that I did enroll in MARS at that time. And one of the benefits of being in MARS is you could get equipment on loan, which was something that was outside of my ability at that time, being a teenager and having limited income. So got set up with a nice receiver, like an R390 Collins receiver. Actually got some teletype equipment, which was that old mechanical stuff, the Model 19, which was kind of funny, that big mechanical monster. And whenever that thing, we were running our teletype net, it would just shake up the whole house when that thing was rattling along. It's much different than what we're doing right now. Nowadays, with computerized everything, it's just so much more compact and quiet. But I got my feet wet with a lot of new technologies for me at that time. Through MARS also, I was able to do some studying. Given the opportunity to take correspondence courses, for example, microwaves and radar, which was offered to the Air Force, to anybody who was a member of MARS. I went ahead and did that. I was interested in that. Through those kind of studies, I went and got my commercial radio telephone operator license with radar endorsements. And just for the heck of it, because I was just really intrigued with all of this technology. And I figured it would also open doors for me if I wanted to pursue that as a career, which I never really did. Physics and electronics and communications have always been an interest of mine, as they have been for many other people who eventually went into the medical professions.
Okay, so how did ham radio play a part in the choices that you made for your career in education? Because you stated earlier before we started that you're a medical doctor, a pediatrician. So
yeah.
So did it play a role?
Well, I have to say that certainly it was very much in keeping with my interest in the scientific method, and study, and there certainly is a lot of applications of technology in medical and health sciences. A lot of physicians are involved, and other health professionals involved in amateur radio as well. We even have an organization called MARCA, which is the Medical Amateur Radio Council, of which I've been a member since I've been a medical student. I have to say, when I was in high school, also we had a there was a radio club in high school I attended, but it had been defunct for a while. We had a faculty moderator who was not licensed. I guess the original people who were licensed had left, but. He was very much encouraging. He was a great mentor with issues that had to do with science and with physics. I took advanced placement physics in school, in high school. And when I went to college, that was at Fordham University back in New York, I went and I took some courses in advanced electronics as well. At that time, it was back in the 70s, took a course in Fortran programming. All of those things were quite interesting to me, and also rounded out my education.
I saw there's a picture of your workbench in the 70s. That must have been in the basement of your parents' house or something like that. And you point out that there's a little gray box that was a Pong console. Were you an early either game system builder or computer in home computing when this stuff first came out?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, I have to say that in addition to becoming a member of the ARRL, I also subscribed to 73 magazine, which Wayne Green, who is the publisher of that magazine, was very much a proponent of computing, and he went and started a number of magazines, such as Byte Magazine, and eventually in 73 Microcomputing. I was just all taken in by the digital revolution and how that was affecting amateur radio. So yeah, we had a little Pong console. I was eventually started out with computers with a little machine that's called the Sinclair ZX81. It's a little kit that you put together. At the time, it was like $99, and I bought the kit for him. I soldered it together and hooked it up to a little black and white analog television, and that was my first monitor. And learned basic programming. Well, at the time, I was in medical school. One of the professors had a PDP-11 microcomputer in his lab, and I was just intrigued by that, and he just invited me in and said, oh, you can come here and sit down at this little terminal and learn basic programming, since the only experience that I had with programming was earlier as an undergraduate was learning Fortran at Fordham, and at that time you had to punch all of your statements and data onto these little punch cards, and you'd have this stack of punch cards that you would drop off the computer center, and you'd come back the next day or two and see if you would get a printout. And if there were no errors in your statements, you would get, you know, a good printout, you know, with all your output. But otherwise, it would say, uh-oh, there was an error. So you'd have to go through it all, go through your stack of cards and try to find where the error was and submit it again the next day.
Yeah, I remember a syntax error on line 10.
Yeah.
So you You'd wait 3 hours for your job to come through, and you had a bad syntax online in one of the cards. There was no immediate gratification.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I remember the computer professor would say that they were so proud about this tremendous computer center they had at Fordham with all the magnetic core memory. that was back then. There was no time sharing terminals back then. And the first time I saw the time sharing terminal was PDP 11. That's this tremendous, absolutely brilliant professor had in his research lab in the medical school. That's when I started with the ZX81. Then I graduated from that to a Commodore 64. And when they came out, the Tandy microcomputers were kind of clones of the original IBM PCs. And I was started out with that, doing basic programming, and actually published a program in a publication, a medical publication called Computers in Biology and Medicine, using some of the calculations that we used in the hospital for managing critically ill children in pediatric wards, and I actually had that article published back then. So there's a lot of crossover between my interest in amateur radio, electronics, and computing as well.
You're a medical doctor, yet you operate, it seems to me, in the hobby at the PhD level in RF engineering. My guess is you could probably teach any RF engineering course in any of the major universities if you wanted to. Why did you choose medicine over over the sciences, physics, or electronics?
Well, that's I have to say that I have more than one interest in my life. One of the interests that I've always had was in working with people. I was very much inspired by our family physician as I was growing up. And my parents, of course, encouraged me to pursue that interest in working in the health profession. And those doors opened up for me. I did not find any incompatibility with pursuing studies on the side on a personal level with electronics. I also have a hobby in music. As a child, also, I started learning piano because I was interested. I just had that kind of a talent, and my parents encouraged that as well. Took 5 years of piano lessons when I was in grade school, and I continue to do that to this day, more or less as a hobby, just for my own pleasure and for playing for friends as well. And there again, musical ability ties in very much with Morse code. I don't know if you've heard others mention that as well. It's all a rhythm and an appreciation for tonality.
Yeah, no, I believe I also do music as well. Mm-hmm. What kind of impact did amateur radio have on your family life?
Well, I could say as a child, there's quite a bit of impact on my family when I was a kid, because I was responsible for all kinds of strange noises coming over the shortwave radio and making lights blink on and off when I was transmitting Morse code, and flickering all the fluorescent lights in the house sometimes. After that, family life, I have to say it's, when I eventually had children of my own, and they saw that my interest in science and interest in radio and communications, it encouraged, especially my daughter is very much interested in technology, although she herself is not licensed as a ham operator, but she has a job. She lives over in Virginia, and she has a very technical job where she is a field representative for a company that makes industrial gauges for industrial machines, manufacturing plants, etc. It's also, I'd say, my husband is very interested in electronics. He's also licensed. He actually got licensed after we met. He likes more just to watch me do my stuff and enjoys participating in the different activities. We go to visit conferences and speak at conferences and just meet the people we do. One of the things that I really love to do in ham radio is teaching and just learning, because I actually learn more just by sharing the things that I learn and getting feedback from others that are doing similar type of work. I have to say something about my website, which you probably saw on QSL.net. That was started way back around 1998. I had never really posted anything online prior to that year. But I had come down with some kind of an illness. At that time, I was living in Omaha, Nebraska. I was in practice there. And so I got some kind of a viral illness that was never really quite figured out. But it struck me with some really high fevers. And I was incapacitated for several weeks. And gone through several studies eventually to resolve. They figured it was some kind of a virus that they never really could figure out. But I was unable to work for those weeks, and I was really bored to death, cooped up in my home, just sweating with fevers from time to time, and I didn't know what I could do. At that time, I was really confined to my room. I would go and see the doctor once in a while and be on medications, et cetera, until it resolved. But I was bored and got on the internet, was looking around, seeing some of the resources there, and then I found this QSL.net site, which was offering a place for people to post stuff. And I could set up a page here. And I went back and I saw some of the things that I had published before. They were in my storage and my papers. And I said, well, let me post some of this stuff up here. And let me go through my logbooks that I've kept from the very beginning when I was active on the air, and start posting different things here and there, just, you know, so I could have a place where I personally can go back and remember this stuff and have a personal ability to access it more easily than going through all the papers I had in a couple of boxes. So it started with that. It was only one or two pages of things that I thought were good to post and a few pictures. And after that, I just kept adding more and more. Whenever I had something else to add, you know, I said, okay, I'm studying this or that other thing in electronics, and I'm going to go ahead and put a little post up there. And after a while, I started getting emails from people who were actually reading that stuff. And some of the emails were from other people who were interested in similar areas and were just sharing their observations and I was actually learning from this, and I found it very satisfying. So I would do extensive searches, you know, through some of the search engines to find out different people's experience with antennas and different types of transmission modes, etc. And when I found something that was interesting, I would investigate it myself and then post some of my own stuff. This was before blogs were very popular, and of course, to post on this QSL.net site back then, you had to learn HTML coding. So that's how I would put it on the web pages. So I have a number of pages that are all linked together on that QSL.net website. And in the meantime, I've had some individuals say, "Well, why don't you go ahead and set up a web blog?" And I just really haven't got the time or the inclination after doing everything that I've done in HTML coding to go ahead and transfer that over to a blog. So that's why I pretty much kept it in that format all this time.
Yeah, I would agree with you that you probably don't need to do that. I mean, it's still quite readable. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I've been looking at your articles online that you've, and obviously it's remarkable because I did know that all of that was done in HTML. And you don't just do a little bit of an article on where you're doing antenna modeling for like the house you had in Omaha, I think, where you're we're actually trying to figure out how to build dipoles and other dipoles and loops inside your attic.
Yeah.
That's a scientific study. I mean, it's an amazing article, and what you've done there is I don't think there's anybody that knows a roof better than you do with regard to what you could do underneath it. But anyway, so I did notice that, and I thought that it was amazing that you were able to put so much information in, and you mastered one of the antenna modeling softwares. Which one is it that you mastered?
The one that I really like to use is Fornek 2. I'm just really impressed by the way that you can use variables in it and have it do calculations to figure out the endpoint coordinates for the different wires that you put in Ella in a model. The outputs that you can get, like the three-dimensional models and the ways you can optimize a model for any particular parameter that you're interested in an antenna. It's a tremendously powerful software, which is completely free. And I was just so enamored of it that I posted quite a few studies that I've done using that particular software, and I've got a good amount of feedback from other people who are interested. And very often I'll get emails from people who have a particular project that they're thinking of, and they'd like some assistance in getting a model for their concept. And I will so certainly help them with that, and just get them hints on how they could make their own models. So I think I'm just really, really happy. It started off with, you know, the MiniNeck, which you may be familiar, which was the old Fortran program, which had a rather clunky user interface. I was just and there again, it's the cross section of amateur radio intersecting with computers and programming and mathematics. I've always been enamored with mathematics as well. One of the first articles that I actually got published in Ham Radio Magazine was an article for calculating the elevation and azimuth to find a amateur radio satellite. That was at the time that the Oscar locator was a popular device, which was a mechanical device that kind of plotted an orbit on a physical map of the world. I said, well, if you need something like that, there should be a way of applying trigonometry, something called spherical trigonometry, in order to get the same results without having to use a mechanical type of device like a slide rule. And the thing that made that really easy for me to do was the ability to use a handheld one of those programmable calculators. I had an SR-52, which was put out by Texas Instruments, which I had a little magnetic card that you would slide through the top of it, and you could actually program a little, like a 200-step program in there, and put in your inputs and come out with numbers that would actually tell you when you can expect to hear a satellite and where it would be and what the distance was and the elevation, et cetera. On a little device like that, which is absolutely amazing to me that anybody could do that. That's like
your KP4MD. That's great, but you're from New York and you live in California. Where did the KP4 come from? It's a Puerto Rican call.
Yes. A lot of people ask me that story as well. Yes, I was originally born and raised in New York City, and my original call was WB20ZA. But I had gone to Puerto Rico a few times since I was well, several times since I was young, because my mother's family is originally from there. And of course, after I got my license, I said, this is a wonderful opportunity to do some DX operating from that location. So I think the first time I operated from there was a summer vacation back in 1974. I packed my HW-101 with a humongous, super heavy power supply in my luggage and set up a station down there, the HW-101, and worked HF, wonderful taste of DX. Eventually, I moved to live in Puerto Rico from 1976 to 1987. I did my medical studies down there, and I did some work with the U.S. Naval Hospital as well. And there was no way that I was going to keep the WB2 call while I was there, because you know, when you're trying to work DX stations, the WB2 is a liability. They say, oh no, you're another one of those New York stations, you know, and it just makes it really hard, especially on CW, to sign a WB2 slant KP4. It was just a little bit too awkward. So, yeah, I changed my call sign first to KP4 Echo Mike November, which was the one I was assigned back then, back in 1976. And I had an extra class license at that time. They offered extra class licensees the option of picking a two-letter call of their choice. It wasn't really a vanity call system back then, but it was a perk that you would had that you had with incentive licensing. And so when that came available to me, and there was absolutely no cost for it back then, I said, okay, let me go for wanted to try to get my initials, Charlie Mike, but that was not available. But Mike Delta was one of the other options. At the time, I was a medical student, so I stuck with it, and I've had that call since 1977. And I have not changed since that time, even though I've had a couple of moves, first to Nebraska and here to California. The only problem I have with that when I get on HF is that sometimes people get a little excited when they hear a KP4 and they figure it's another DX country for them, especially since I'm now here in California. I try sometimes on HF to put slant 6 in there so that they know I'm operating from the States and not from Puerto Rico. There are a few others of us, like KH6s and KL7s, that have moved back to the continental United States after getting those call signs. If you're currently in the continental United States, you cannot apply for those call signs as a new call sign because they are technically still restricted to those areas outside the United States.
You know, I had Angel Santana on in episode 3, WP3GW, uh-huh. And he was saying that the Puerto Rican public knows the amateurs and they call them KP4s.
Correct.
So when you hear the people on the street saying, "Oh yeah, those KP4s," they're referring to the Puerto Rican amateur radio operators. It was actually kind of a funny thing.
Yes, KP4. That's what they call us.
Yeah, okay. KP4, right. Do you think that there are any challenges that are exclusive to women in ham radio?
I think there's certainly challenges for women in any kind of technical or scientific field that have been predominantly dominated by males. First of all, I think we really have to prove ourselves that we can actually say something that's worth listening to. I had a kind of experience in that area, for example, with the amateur radio club that I'm currently really active here in the Sacramento area, which is the River City Amateur Radio Communication Society. They have a call sign, N6NA, and I've been active with them now for about 10 years. When I first joined them, I would just listen to some of their meetings, and I decided that perhaps I would like to help them out with some of their technical presentations. So I spoke with the president of the club, and I said, well, I'd like to do a little talk about some of the stuff that I've been doing, that I've been posting online. And they said, okay, they'll give me a chance. And I actually did do a few presentations. I think one of the first things I did was a presentation on the Whisper communications mode, which is a weak signal propagation reporter network, together with another one of the members. And before I know it, I was given an opportunity to run for the board of directors, and I was elected to the board of directors, and then I was even offered a position directly within a month or two of that to serve as president, which I did serve as president for 3 years of that club. It's the first time they ever had a woman as the president, and I very clearly remember there were a lot of members that, of course, the club is primarily a boys' club to start off with. There were a few other women members. But this is the first time they ever had a woman as president. And it took a little bit of time to convince there were some skeptical people that a woman could actually do the job. But I actually took it as a great opportunity for opportunities for teaching and learning. Brought a lot of technical programs to the club, and eventually got to become also webmaster for that for their website as well, and did a revision of their website. So if the men out there would just give us a chance to show that we can actually do it as well as anyone else, a lot of men are willing to accept us as equals and give us an opportunity. You know, in the past, well, there's still some organizations there specifically for YL, young ladies, like the Young Ladies Radio League, which was a space that women needed, because it was hard, you know, to find a place of acceptance among a hobby that was dominated mostly by men. But now we have even a woman head of the American Radio Relay League. Our president is Kay Craig. She is a wonderful woman. I've met her several times. I think we're getting more and more an appreciation that anybody, regardless of their gender, can contribute to the hobby.
You operate a Whisper node on VHF and UHF, which I actually thought was kind of unusual, because a lot of people like really long, you know, low-frequency, long-path propagation reports. Why did you choose those two bands, and what have you learned from that?
I have a Whisper station been operating now for, I guess, closer to about 4 years on 2 meters, so also on 432. So of course, I started in amateur radio on VHF, and I found that VHF and UHF have some interesting propagation phenomena that perhaps we don't quite completely understand. There is some other stations over in the Bay Area, which is not too far from here, Sacramento, who had also done some work with VHF and UHF, and that was a group over in the Santa Rosa area, M6GN and K6PZB, who had previously done some work with Whisper. It was just between them two, and then it kind of died away. But I decided that I wanted to try and contact them using that mode. It's a little bit of a challenge since we have a couple of mountain ranges in between us, and we have a distance of somewhere around 90 miles or so. And we're just wondering, you know, how could we do this with limited antennas, since where I'm living right now, we're in an antenna-restricted community. It's a mobile home park. I'm very comfortable with living in a home like this because it takes it's a small type of home that doesn't require a lot of maintenance. But we have challenges putting up antennas, and I was lucky to be able to get a couple of halo antennas up and use relatively moderate power, something around 10 or 20 watts to begin with. And I was wondering, you know, can we do this on something like 2 meters, you know, to regularly get communications over those distances, over mountain ranges, et cetera, using a narrow band digital mode like Whisper. And we were surprised to see that we could do this on a regular basis when I got in contact with those stations. And then we had more and more stations around the Bay Area that started getting interested in joining us. We eventually developed a network of stations up and down the West Coast, going down as far as Bakersfield area. We have a station down near KC6KGE in Taft, California, who's almost 400 miles south of us, who joined us, and we were experiencing what it is like to get propagation on omnidirectional antennas with very modest power, using a narrowband digital mode. Most of the times when you heard that sort of stuff going on, people were using high power and high gain antennas and high towers. But for people like us, that some of us had antenna restrictions, we were able to accomplish pretty much the same thing using low powers. So we found interesting things going on with tropospheric propagation, tropospheric openings. We found that we were getting some enhancement of signals from aircraft scatter, what we would call aircraft scatter, and some really strange things that would happen to signals from what we think are wingtip vortices, which are perturbations in the atmosphere that occur from aircraft that would cause some really strange modulations to our signals. So we've pretty much compiled a lot of the things that we found and put it on a web page, and we have a discussion group also online that has posted a lot of what we found. And we've done presentations at regional conferences, and it's brought a good amount of interest. So we've had some stations from as far north as Washington State have joined us in these studies as well. And there's a lot of hams down in Australia that do it as well. They have their own group down there, and a number of people in Europe also that are doing studies on UHF and VHF Whisper.
Now, the HALO antenna is horizontally polarized?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And there, you have great pictures online of the HALO antenna that you actually constructed yourself. You have beautiful construction technique, by the way. So it's very impressive. And what kind of station are you using to drive the antenna?
The station I'm using on 2 meters and also on 432, I'm using a Flex 1500, which is it's a QRP software-defined radio that's also quite popular to use to drive transverters, because it has transverter output and input, and it can be disciplined with a GPS frequency reference to lock to within 1 hertz. And we really do need a lot of stability when we're using VHF and UHF Whisper, because any drift further more than about 3 or 4 hertz during a 2 minute transmission can cause a loss of decoding with that particular mode. You need that much stability. And I use a couple of transverters. I have an Elecraft XV144, which is a 2 meter transverter. And I also have an amplifier that when I need to, I can put a little bit more power up to around 100 watts out into those stacked HALO antennas on 2 meters. And on 432, I have a downeast microwave transverter for 432. I can't run any more than 50 watts here. We're in most of California, we're limited to a maximum transmitter power of 50 watts because of paved PAWS, which I think you might be familiar with.
Okay, I'll put that in the show notes. That's the over-the-horizon radar, right, that the military is running in the Northern California?
It's actually a radar that operates in the 420 to 450 megahertz range, and that radar has to do with tracking satellites and debris that's in orbit around the world. I mean, we really have, it's absolutely important and critical to have that kind of tracking of all of the equipment and debris that's out there from old defunct satellites, etc., to avoid anything like a catastrophic collision with the International Space Station. The more stuff that we put up into space, the more dangerous it becomes to be up there when you have these things zooming around at 18,000 miles per hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we forget that we the UHF bands and all the frequencies, I think, above 430, 420 megahertz, mm-hmm. we know we share with other services as secondary mm-hmm. users. So I guess in Northern California, PavePaws is the primary user, and operation in those areas has to be restricted.
Yeah.
I've heard this, yeah.
Yes, there's a similar location around around Cape Cod, Massachusetts, I believe, on the East Coast as well, where they have a restricted area, and there's some other parts of the United States that...
Yeah, Virginia, I think there's something around in Virginia. Mm-hmm. There were some nuclear facilities or, you know, research areas, so there's some quiet areas over there,
yeah.
too. What is your other rig? What's the rig that you operate the most?
Well, when I'm not doing Whisper, I operate nets here on a regular basis. Our radio club has a number of weekly nets, and I've been involved with them quite regularly for about the past 4 or 5 years. We have a 2-meter net to our repeater on Wednesday nights, and following that, we've been doing a 10-meter net on single sideband. To encourage some of the technician operators to get a taste of HF operation, to encourage them to get some 10-meter, their 10-meter facilities operating, so perhaps they can even advance and be interested in advancing their license class and getting more into HF operation. And we also have been doing a slow scan TV net on 2-meter FM as well, which is... kind of interesting. We thought this would be a way for people to get a little taste of a different mode other than just talking on their FM radio, since so many people, when they get their first license, the first thing they do is they get just an HT or a 2-meter mobile radio, and they spend most of the time just talking through repeaters. Well, this is a way that you can use that equipment with some free software you can download and use it on your computer and see pictures coming over your radios. And so they'll learn a little bit about slow scan, which eventually they may want to operate on HF as well. Of course, there's applications for slow scan TV and emergency communications as well, so it can help people get into that area. But we've actually been using the slow scan as a teaching tool. A number of our members that are active in that do things like some of the projects that I do, you know, just investigations with different modes and putting together different projects. We take pictures of these things and we send them over slow scan on this net, and we spend time just discussing what we're doing and some of our findings, and we get feedback. And so it's an opportunity to do a little bit of a teaching online. Well, it's actually over the air using slow scan visual aids. One of our members of our slow scan net is actually Blind Tam, which I find quite intriguing, but he certainly has a lot of questions from the stuff that we're describing, because I guess he's just imagining the stuff there from the pictures, and he's interested in learning. That's KC5JAX, who's and he's been a regular member of our slow scan net, but of course he can't send pictures, but he loves to join in our discussion.
I remember slow scan TV from the 70s, when there was a company in San Diego named Robot that used to make slow scan equipment. It always it seemed to me that the pictures are very low resolution, very, you know, green and grainy. Has that changed?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I remember back then in those times of the robot equipment, which of course came out when I was in high school, and was the price of that equipment was way beyond my ability to get those dedicated hardware. Using the the P7 phosphor, long duration phosphor. I know Wayne Green was a big proponent of that mode, and he did a lot of publishing in 73 magazine about slow scan TV back then. And just the floodgates for that sort of mode open, wide open, when computer technology came into amateur radio, and we had the opportunity to emulate that hardware and software. So now it's become so simple with a little laptop computer that is so ubiquitous nowadays, or even smartphones that can send and receive those images. And the modes that we have now are way higher resolution and colors, and it's absolutely tremendously better. Of course, FastScan TV is available on the higher ranges like UHF and microwave, where you can have regular motion television like you have commercial television. But those kind of modes require more broader bandwidth, and being on those higher frequencies, their ranges are a lot more limited. Here in Northern California, there is a repeater on Mount Diablo, which is over in the San Francisco area, that I believe is up around 1296 frequency range. And we're a little bit on the fringes for that. And of course, with my antenna restrictions, it's very difficult for me to set up a station for that. I'm not active in that around here. But I have been active in FastScan ATV in the past, and that's in a whole nother story.
I actually saw that, and I'll point that out on the show notes page, that it appeared to me that mm-hmm. you were doing FastScan television in the 70s.
That's correct. Back in New York City, I used a converted Motorola commercial transmitter that was called the Twin V. They were tube radios that were removed from commercial service when they were changing from wideband to narrowband FM. So a lot of this equipment was becoming available through places. There was an outfit in New Jersey called Gregory Electronics that sold a lot of that commercial equipment that was removed from service to the ham community. And that was a transmitter that had vibrator power supply. And what we would do is we'd pull out the vibrators, and we would put a high current 12-volt AC transformer into the connections for the vibrators. And that would supply all the high voltages to all the tubes in the circuit of the transmitter. And we would modulate the final to put some video on there from videos that we would get, video signal that we would get from closed-circuit TV cameras that were also decommissioned, which was not too hard to find, because a lot of businesses had these Vidicon-based closed-circuit TV cameras that they were, you know, left in one position for a long time, and eventually they'd get a little bit of an image burn into the Vidicon screen. So they had to remove them from service, and they were also made available to us at low cost. And we would use them. You'd get pretty usable black and white images from those, you know, the regular NTSC video, analog video. And we were able to put signals out on the air for very low cost. And we had everything was simplex back then. We were on 439.25 megahertz, and there was a number of publications. A5 magazine was quite popular back then, and I did publish a couple of articles in A5 magazine back then in the 70s. When I left New York City, which was back in 1976, I wasn't near any population centers that had a lot of that kind of activity until I moved to Nebraska. That was in 87. They actually had an ATV repeater on top of one of the television towers there, which was really important for them. They used a remote control camera at the top of this, it was a 1,400-foot tower for a tornado spotting. And that's what they used ATV for there. And they had a full ATV repeater that was available for anybody to use. And so I got into that back then for a little bit as well when I was in Nebraska.
What's the latest project you're working on now?
One of the latest things that I've been doing is I just bought a KX3 kit. I put it together and been playing with that for the past week. It's brand new here. And I'm going to be doing some evaluations of some commercial magnetic loop antennas. Going to do that. Just received the Chameleon F-loop for evaluation, and some of the other hams around here have some other commercial loops, so we're going to do some shootouts to see how they compare and do some evaluations. And
do you think you're going to do any radar?
No, not. I just listened to that South African ham that was talking about the radar program where you go out and walk.
Going to take that KX3 out into the woods?
Well, that's certainly a possibility. Just have to get more free time to go out and do a little bit more physical activity. that is a kind of a physically demanding activity, you know, carrying that heavy stuff and setting up and then moving on. I basically am an indoor person. About the most outdoor activity I have is doing field day at the club. So, I'm quite impressed by the younger people that have the stamina to do that kind of stuff.
The KX3 is a very elegant, can be a home station. You know, it's so
no
beautiful.
No question. I met Eric Schwartz, WA6HHQ, at the Nevada State Convention, just about a week and a half ago. And, I mentioned that I had listened to the QSO Today podcast, where you talked to Wayne. And I said, I felt like I knew these guys very, very well because I listened to that entire podcast and the story behind Elecraft. So we had an immediate connection there. But, this was at the, Nevada State Convention, there was an Elecraft, there was a booth. And I sat down, and right there is where I ordered the KX3. And I had a wonderful, wonderful talk there with Eric. Wayne wasn't at that particular presentation, but, you know, I thank you so much that much insight into the history of Elecraft because you posted that podcast.
What do you think are the biggest challenges that amateur radio faces now?
I think some of the challenges we have is we still have to overcome some of the old stereotypes that people have. A lot of people say, "Oh, ham radio was an old." All type of activity for eccentric people, you know, years and years ago. And nowadays we have so many other means of communication that renders amateur radio kind of obsolete. Because that's what a lot of people still have in their mind. Oh, do people still use amateur radio? Do people still use Morse code? Why would they do that? Because anybody could pick up a smartphone and talk anywhere in the world. So there's still that conception out there, but that has actually, there's been more, we're getting some progress and getting over those stereotypes with the prominence of amateur radio now coming to the forefront and the role that's being played in disasters as a dependable backup means of communication. And as many of your other speakers here on QSO Today have mentioned as well, it's something that's really attractive also to the maker community. There are more and more young people that are interested in doing some hands-on creativity in whatever area it is, with computers and with communications. And amateur radio is now offering itself as an avenue for those kind of activities. And we're getting more and more young people actually interested in seeing that it's really cool. I remember back when I got into amateur radio, I felt that there were a lot of old timers that were resistant to any kind of innovations and the new ideas that were coming in. And it was kind of a challenge. It's still for a lot of young people, they perhaps see that sort of thing, because there are a lot of old ideas that are entrenched in amateur radio, but there are people who are still moving forward. For example, with digital voice communications, That's one of the areas right now where we're seeing a little bit of tension in this area in California, where like 2 meter, the 2 meter band is pretty much saturated with existing analog analog repeaters, and people want to put up things like G-Star and motor turbo repeaters, and there's a lot of competition for frequency spectrum that it's pretty much saturated. So some of the old ways are going to have to give way to the new. And the issue with digital voice, I'm very much in favor of it. I have some concerns, though, for when you're using proprietary codecs, etc., which kind of, I think, goes against the spirit of amateur radio. And I think you've had Bruce Perrins talking about that here as well in the past. And when you're having non-compatible systems out there, because as far as I know historically, the whole point in amateur radio is to maintain compatibility completely across the hobby. And when we're going into different camps where some are using V-Star, some using System Fusion, some using Motor Turbo, and none of them can talk to each other. This is something that has to be resolved eventually, because we need to be all to be able to speak with each other.
Yeah, I've been a little bit resistant to some of the digital modes like D-Star and Fusion mm-hmm. as well. You know, we're always here in Israel. We're always looking at, you know, what else can we do that's different. Although we have a ham population that's disappearing more than than gaining, but proprietary modes in ham radio just don't seem to be in the spirit of the hobby. So I'd agree with you there. Mm-hmm. What advice would you give to new or returning hams to the hobby?
I would recommend that people interested in amateur radio should read and read and read. The internet is a tremendous resource for the flow of information. A lot of it is valid and some of it is questionable. So eventually you're going to have to develop through experience a critical eye. That's, as you mentioned, you know, a lot of the stuff that I put online on my website is kind of uses an application of the scientific method, which had to do with my training, you know, in the sciences. Where you have a hypothesis and you go and try it out yourself and put your results there and see how they measure up against what other people have done, and not take everything on face value because somebody happens to post something in some kind of a discussion group that this is the absolute gospel truth. Things have to be evaluated for their veracity, you know, and one of the best ways you can do that to see if any results are reproducible. So you have to read and you have to study, and this is a learning process, and be willing to admit that you're wrong sometimes. Some of these individuals, especially those that get involved in flaming on some of these groups, it's just they're not willing really to admit they're possibly that they're wrong, or perhaps there's another way of appreciating something, or another way of looking at a particular phenomenon or a practice or a result. So
what is flaming?
Flaming is an activity on things like internet discussion groups or social media, where you just happen to criticize someone and do it in a malicious manner. It's basically just
with a disregard to the facts.
Exactly. Well, yes. Or, you know, because they disagree with you, you go ahead and you disrespect them.
As a new ham starting out, I remember the technical conversation at the ham clubs being over my head. I've gotten some emails from listeners that have said that the level of technical conversation on QSO Today may be too technical. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah. Let me tell you, when I started in amateur radio, a lot of this stuff was over my head. And when I first became a member of the AWRL, I was getting these issues of QST, and I didn't understand half of the stuff that was in there. But I forced myself to read it, and I said, one of these days, it's all going to come together. And it does. You know, little by little, things start clicking, and by osmosis, you start becoming more and more familiar with the lingo. And then you can go back to stuff you read that you didn't quite understand. And I was, oh, that's what that means. So it is worth doing this sort of thing. It is worth listening to all these different podcasts talking about these exotic modes and these different areas of investigation like mesh networks, et cetera, that people are doing, because this information may be useful to you in some time in the future. And you may be able to contribute a little bit to the art and the science in those areas. Let me just also say that when I started listening to podcasts and to your format and asking these questions, it made me think immediately of my QSL.net page, because the first thing I put on there that was very prominent was a section I call Highlights from the Logbook, and it has bullet points, and those bullet points, I figure, wow, I think you probably saw that and you said, this makes all of your work easier for you, because you'll be able to pick out the ones that you want to ask about and discuss. And, that made me go back to that page and say, okay, where else can I fill in stuff and make maybe perhaps some corrections, you know, about some stuff that I reminisced about and had forgotten about. So, I appreciate your contacting me because I did that. I went through that page, and I brought it up to date, and I remembered my Elmers that I were completely out of my mind for years and years and years, and mention in there, and I feel so much better now that I have done that, and it's out there for people to read and perhaps get some inspiration to reach out and help other people as well.
So I'm with you 100%. You've got to spend some time on the internet and actually find your place and apply the scientific method to that place and become an expert in it, and then move on maybe if you certainly have done that. I have 100 questions I could ask you, Carol, that are here, but I at this point I think we've run out of time, and I am so delighted and so grateful that you were able to clear your schedule and find time for a QSO today.
After you contacted me, I said, well, let me go back and see what some of these things you discuss on your QSO podcast. I was absolutely amazed and listening to all these different people. I've actually listened since then up to from number one up to number 27 of your podcast.
Oh, I'm great. And, I'm amazed.
And listening, you know, about subjects that never really attracted my attention particularly, but hearing these stories from the very beginning of these, you know, where these people come from, have just opened up my interest and really broadened my appreciation for the variety of interests and opportunities there are to learn in amateur radio. For example, there was one individual, KK4WW, who has a microcomputer museum out there in Floyd, Virginia. It just happens that this summer I'm going to be traveling out there to visit my daughter, just about a half an hour away from where that is. I didn't even realize that was there, so I'm going to try and do my best to go and actually visit this in this museum and get to meet KK4WW myself.
Well, he's very active on social media, and he is more than welcoming, you know, to have people visit his museum there.
Mm-hmm. I have to say that amateur radio has opened so many doors to meet some really amazing individuals like Joe Taylor. I would really suggest you try to get K1JT on here. Dr. Joseph Taylor is the inventor of Whisper and the WSJT modes. He's a wonderful person. He's a Nobel Prize laureate, you know, in astrophysics, and who got his start in amateur radio in high school by putting together a science project, which was a radio telescope, from information he got from the Radio Amateur's Handbook. I had the pleasure of meeting him at Pacificon back in 2011 when I gave my first presentation of the Arecibo Observatory documentary video that we put together. We shared stage there, and he talked about the AME expedition to Arecibo while I was doing the video presentations. And he's a tremendous individual. I'm sure you should have him on your program as well.
Well, I would love to have Joe Taylor. And he is welcome anytime on the QSO Today podcast. Carol, thanks so much for coming on to QSO Today. It's been my great pleasure. I'll post everything that we've talked about and that I can remember on the show notes page. I encourage all of the listeners to not only go to my show notes page, but also go to Carol's site, and I'll post that link on the show notes page. I have a great appreciation for what you've done and what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, 73.
73, Eric. Thank you so much.
That concludes this episode of QSO Today. I hope that you enjoyed my QSO Today with Carol, KP4MD. I encourage you to check out the show notes page at www.qsotoday.com and put in KP4MD in the search bar at the top of the page. I will post links to the references that Carol made in the podcast. As I mentioned in the interview, Carol is meticulous about documenting everything she does in both writing, with lots of illustrations, and now YouTube video. If you have any questions for Carol, please be sure to put them in the comments section at the bottom of the KP4MD show notes page. QSO Today is available in the iTunes Store and in the Stitcher podcast app for both iPhone and Android. There are links to these places on the QSO Today website. I'm always on the lookout for interesting guests for the podcast. Your suggestions are very important to finding QSO Today guests. Please send me your suggestions on the comments page at the www.qsotoday.com website. Please take the time to join the QSO Today community. There are buttons on the website and on the show notes pages for this. I promise not to spam you or share your email address with anyone. Until next time, this is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73.